Good morning. A bit cold in our household, but I haven't succumbed yet. I was wondering whether I'd be talking with a croaky voice this morning, but no, not yet. Winter is upon us, although it's sunny today. Early in the morning of the 25th of April this year, in Queens, New York, a startling incident was caught on CCTV. A woman was followed by a man who then accosted her. 31-year-old Hugo Alfredo Taliats, who was walking behind them, caught up with them. He was then stabbed several times in the torso while he tried to save the woman. The attacker ran away. Taliats starts to chase him, but then collapses. 1 minute later, a person walks right by. And so does the next person, and the one after that. A procession of more than 20 people notice Taliats on the ground, yet fail to help. One man even pulls out a mobile and snaps a picture. Another man nudges him and rolls him over twice, sees his blood, and then walks away. He lay there for about an hour and a half before someone finally called emergency services. But by then it was too late. Why? Is it because he'd recently lost his job, become homeless, and perhaps looked homeless? Is it because people thought someone else would deal with it? It's a scary situation. Jesus told a similar story that we'd just heard. It was to help a man understand what it meant to love his neighbour as himself. So today we're going to be looking at that story and the question that prompted it: who is my neighbour? Fortunately, in the story, there was a Good Samaritan. Well, the story today that we're looking at is part of the answer to an assessment. Jesus was a new teacher on the scene, and he was attracting the crowds with his ideas, which some people were taking to be almost revolutionary. He claimed to know how people were to follow God. Those with responsibility for the nation's spiritual heritage took that sort of thing seriously, especially when this sort of alternative teaching was in danger of becoming popular with the ordinary people. It was their job to ensure that the people were kept on the straight and narrow, and that misinterpretations of God's law didn't become popular. They were the shepherds of God's people. They had the authority to properly interpret and teach God's law. This new preacher needed to be sussed out, to check out that his theology was correct. And so it was that a lawyer, an expert in the law, came to test Jesus with an important theological question. Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? If we look in the Gospels, we see that Jesus was asked the same question on other occasions by a rich young ruler and by a Pharisee named Nicodemus. But on those occasions, the question was asked sincerely. There was a genuine desire to know what Jesus would say in response. And perhaps that's why in those cases Jesus answers the question. In this case, he bounces it straight back to the lawyer. What is written in the law? How do you read it? The lawyer appears to be happy to provide an answer. He quotes from Deuteronomy and Leviticus, "To love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and to love your neighbour as yourself." I find it quite strange that there's a role reversal here. The man came to test Jesus, but in the end Jesus becomes the teacher. And he responds by commending the lawyer for his answer, telling him that he's correct and that if he obeys the command, he will live. I suspect that the lawyer sensed that he'd been put on the back foot by Jesus. And in an attempt to save losing face, he asks Jesus a stickier question, one that perhaps was less easy to answer. So, we're to love our neighbour. Who is my neighbour? This man was a lawyer, an expert in the law of Moses. His role would have been to ensure that the law was correctly interpreted so that it could be followed. And his question isn't trivial. To understand what the word neighbour meant in the context of the law was of great importance. As Jesus said, this was the second greatest command, and it was critical that people understood clearly how to keep it. Unfortunately, though, it appears that the Jews had misinterpreted the verse to love your neighbour as yourself. So that's found in Leviticus 19. In Matthew 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, we find Jesus critiquing the way the teachers of the law had interpreted the law. And one of the points he picks up on relates to this verse. The rabbis had a saying. They said, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. Jesus quotes that. He says, you have heard it was said, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. I say, love your enemy and do good to those who persecute you. So where does this saying of the rabbis come from? Love your neighbour and hate your enemy. Well, the first part comes straight from Leviticus 19, as we heard. Love your neighbour. But the saying as a whole was inaccurate. Firstly, the words as yourself have been left out, somehow helping to soften the requirements of what true love demands. Secondly, hate your enemy had been added. It's true that there are passages in the Old Testament where the writers speak of hating those who hate God. For example, Psalm 139. However, taken in context, these passages seem to be more likely referring to a hatred of evil rather than a hatred of the evildoer. Nowhere are the Jewish people instructed to hate their enemies. In fact, quite the contrary. For example, Proverbs 25 says, if your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he's thirsty, give him water to drink. In interpreting the law, the experts in the law had altered the law. The result was that the term neighbour had been made manageable. It had been reduced to apply only to those who weren't enemies, probably to the Jews alone or to the righteous. So the lawyer tests Jesus with the second question, who is my neighbour and who isn't? Who's eligible to receive my love? And to answer the lawyer's question, Jesus tells a story. A story we're probably all familiar with. The setting's on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. I've never been to Israel, but Google Maps tells me that they're about 17 miles apart, which is just further than from here to Bath. But Jerusalem is 3,500 feet above Jericho, which is right down by the Dead Sea. To put it in context, that's about the height of, or more than the height of Scafell Pike. I've never climbed Scafell Pike, but I imagine it's small. I mean big. Sorry, I come from New Zealand. The hills over here are... Anyway, 3,500 feet is quite a climb in that short distance. The books say that the road between the two took a steep and treacherous descent, and it was notorious for thieves. So this man sets off on his journey, and lo and behold, is set upon by robbers. They strip him, beat him, and leave him half dead. But thankfully, there are other travellers on the road. The first to pass is a priest from the temple, followed closely by a Levite, a lesser temple official. They were probably on their way back to Jericho after completing their temple duties. Actually, their reaction to the man is not unexpected. lying naked without his clothing, it would have been near impossible to tell if he was someone who ought to be helped, if he was one of us. In any case, if he were already dead, and if they touched him, they would be unclean. All in all, from the lawyer's perspective, their reaction may well have been quite understandable. The next character to enter Jesus' story is a Samaritan. Samaritans, strangely enough, were the people who lived in the region of Samaria. After the fall of the northern kingdom of Israel to the Assyrians 700 years before, the king of Assyria had sent people from other parts of his kingdom to inhabit the captured land, a great technique for breaking up resistance. They probably intermarried with the Jews that remained there. They adopted some of the Jewish practices, worshipping Yahweh alongside their own gods. And we read later on, when Ezra returned back to Israel to rebuild the temple, the Samaritans approached with an offer to help. However, later on it became clear what their true intentions were when they set out on a campaign to oppose and discourage the Israelites and the Jews from rebuilding the temple. And from that point on, the Samaritans and the Jews were hostile toward each other. Jews wouldn't associate with Samaritans. They despised them. By the lawyer's definition, a Samaritan would almost certainly not be considered a neighbour. But in Jesus' story, it's the Samaritan who is the true neighbour to the wounded man. And I think it's the Samaritan that offers us a great model to follow. He does four things. Firstly, he sees. He has his eyes open. Might be helpful to, I don't know if you've got a Bible in front of you, to turn to the passage. And we can read it. But a Samaritan as he travelled. Sorry, it's on page 1042. A Samaritan, as he travelled, came where the man was, and when he saw him... So the first thing he does is to see him. He has his eyes open to the world around him. Both the priest and the Levite saw him as well, but in some way it was only seeing to serve their own interests, so as to avoid difficulties of having to deal with someone else's mess. The Samaritan, on the other hand, saw the need. Secondly, he sees with compassion. When the priest and the Levite see the man, they are indifferent to his plight. They walk by on the other side. They exhibit what the psychologists would call diffusion of responsibility. It's not my problem. Someone else will deal with it. In contrast, the Samaritan sees the man is in trouble and is moved by his plight. It costs us to get emotionally involved in someone else's trouble, but the Samaritan was ready and willing to do this. The God we serve is not one who shies away from the pain of emotional involvement. He's willing to love us, even though it means suffering the pain of rejection a million times over. The third thing is, he sees with compassion and acts. No doubt the Samaritan had business of his own to attend to. He was on a journey. He had somewhere to go. If he didn't act, he would have carried on his journey. He would have quickened his step until he'd passed by. But he didn't. He stopped and he went to the man. I think that when I reflect on my own life, there have been too many occasions when I've failed to act. It's a couple of times when I'm on the way to work and I've been cycling along and I've seen something, but I've just cycled past. And rather than stop to help someone push a car that's broken down or something similar to that, I've just cycled past. And as I've cycled on, I thought, I should have stopped. And although maybe that's a trivial example, I want to be someone who acts out of compassion and doesn't just walk on by. The fourth thing is, he sees with compassion, he acts, and he takes care of the man. His compassion is borne out in mercy and tenderness, and it's at great personal cost. He went to him, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." It cost him. It delayed him in his journey. Are we prepared to be delayed in our journey or in a task that we're currently pursuing to help someone in need? Secondly, it was an inconvenience. I'm not sure how comfortable it is to ride on a donkey, but this man gave up that comfort to bring this man to safety. He was inconvenienced. And thirdly, it cost him financially. Effectively, he left this man an open tab to get well. And a striking characteristic of the care that he offers is that it's not limited to this one encounter. He remains personally concerned for the man, for his complete restoration. And it's not in a controlling or condescending or self-fulfilling way, but out of genuine concern for his well-being. And Jesus doesn't say that he struck up a lifelong friendship with the man. What he did do was he remained concerned and continued to support the man until he was fully restored to health. So the Good Samaritan is a model for us, but it's also a model to us of what God has done for us. God has seen us as we are, broken, lost, and in need of him. He has loved us, having mercy on us, and has acted, sending his own son to bear the consequences of our sin and allow us to know and enjoy him. And he is committed to us for the long haul. He is faithful. Discipleship is about imitation. Imitating the God that we serve. We love others, even those who won't return the favour, even those who answer with spite. We are a neighbour to all who cross our path, because we are children of our Father, who has done the same to us. It's the contrast that makes this story so compelling. The spiritually elite versus the spiritually dubious. The purebred Jew versus the unclean half-caste. Yet the generous compassion versus the cold indifference. The practical care versus the walking by on the other side. But although the comparisons are stark, and although his Jewish listeners may well have been ashamed that a Samaritan was the one who showed mercy, I don't think Jesus' aim was to shame his listeners into action. As I've read the story, I've been struck by the way that Jesus doesn't so much answer the lawyer's question as seek to change the question the lawyer is asking. He seems to want to change the way the lawyer thinks. Look at the question that the lawyer asks. Who is my neighbour? At the end of the story, Jesus asks the lawyer a question. Which of these three do you think was a neighbour to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? Do you see the change in perspective there? It was as if the lawyer was asking, who deserves my compassion? Who is eligible to be my neighbour? Where does the boundary lie? The question Jesus asks is, who has been the best neighbour to this man? The question's not, who is my neighbour, but rather, who can I be a neighbour to? How can I be a neighbour to you? And changing the question means that we change the way we see the world. When we ask, who is my neighbour? We begin to think about grouping people, separating them by some characteristic or other, maybe by whether they behave in a predictable way, or whether they are likely to return my neighbourliness. We begin to think about people in general and how we can label and sort them. But when we ask, how can I be a neighbour to you? We start thinking about individuals, and we start thinking about the here and now. Our neighbour is the person we sit next to on the train who looks in need of conversation. Our neighbour is the slightly awkward student who in our class who no one sits next to. Our neighbour is the friend in a faraway city that God has just prompted us to send a letter to. Our neighbour is the person God has brought across our path today. We don't need a textbook definition of who our neighbour is. What we need is eyes to see how we can show compassion to the neighbour that God has brought across our path today. We need to be available. So discipleship is about imitation. It's about imitating the God that we serve, the God who has seen us as we are, and yet loved us and had mercy on us, and who invites us through Christ to share eternity with him. Praise God that he has been much more than a neighbour to us. And as Jesus ends his story, let us go and do likewise. Let us go and do the same. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Should we just pray to close?